You're listening to TechNest,
the Prop Tech Podcast.
In each episode, you'll hear from prop tech founders, investors, and industry veterans on how they're using tech to change the way we buy, sell, and invest in real estate. Discover market opportunities, interesting data, growth tactics, and trends driving the industry forward. This isn't just another podcast about making money in real estate.
This is about how we live.
And now your host, Nate Smoyer.
Hey, Gavin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Nate. Good to see you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on. I know pre-show we were kind of talking about how our circles overlap quite a bit. And you were even featured in an article that a CEO of our company was featured in like a week or so ago. And I just thought about that. I was like, right before our recording, you know, this is the first time we're having a chance to have a conversation. I was like, what are the chances of all that coming together at the same time? But kind of cool. And I think exciting. We'll use that for some fodder for some conversation here. But for those listening, I've got Gavin Myers. He's managing partner at Prudence. Prudence is an early stage venture capital firm. They invest in technology companies leading transformation throughout the real estate sector. They've got some exciting news. By the time this episode airs, I think this will be live because, well, we're going to hold the episode until the news is live. But they've got a new fund and we're going to get into some details with that. But before we get into all that jazz, what were you doing before PropTech? What was the transition to make you even go the route? Because Prudence has been around for some years, but talk me through the, you saw the light and just went all in on PropTech.
Well, Nate, thanks for having me on and yeah, happy to share the news of our latest fund. But you know, I think probably a little bit of history is helpful here. And in the case of Prudence, you know, maybe I'll even go back to my early days, kind of coming out of college, working in the technology sector at the tail end of the dot-com bubble. I worked for a guy named Frank Quattrone at what was at the time called the CSFB Technology Group, which is really at the center of the technology world in the late 1990s. Back in those days, you really didn't have later stage growth capital, pre-IPO capital. And so companies with $25, $30 million of revenue were going public. And so from my early days as just a professional, if that's what you can call a first and second year investment banking analyst, we were working with companies that just raised their Series A. So we were working with early stage companies, didn't have a lot of infrastructure, had an initial product, some customers, and a deep belief that they could build out an industry-defining company. And so my entire career focus has been around that early stage business. And of course, at the time I was a generalist, but I went to business school. I spent 5 years in middle market private equity, thought that that's something that I would enjoy. But the truth was the technology ecosystem in New York was starting to evolve then. And from 2005 to 2009, these were really the early days. And I was spending my nights and weekends working with early stage companies. And in 2009, I met a family who wanted to back a new platform. And so with a single family providing working capital, investment capital, we started making investments. And really we too were generalists. We were investing across industries and made some great investments outside of the prop tech sector, as well as had some important learnings as an investor. But it was really in 2012, we were seed investors in Compass, which at the time was actually called Urban Compass. And that was kind of a fun initial foray into a sector that wasn't even called prop tech at the time, but just real estate technology. And then I had been friends with Robert Refkin from our days in graduate school. And I happened to be in the same office as Ori Alon, who is the director of engineering of Twitter, who later became Rob's co-founder at Compass. And so Rob would work out of my office on his initial pitch deck for Compass, meeting with Ori when Ori was free. And of course, he's the type of person that, you know, I backed for whatever he was doing. And we backed him then. So I would say that we weren't kind of intentionally pivoting into prop tech early on, but it was from that investment that we had this unique vantage point into the real estate sector. And at the time, like, our vantage point was just into residential. But boy, I mean, when you start looking at the statistics, right, $260 trillion of global asset value, largest global contributor to GDP, and having been in the technology sector for my entire career, I had seen how technology had started to propagate other industry sectors. And once it began, of course, it doesn't reverse. And there was just this fundamental question of kind of why now? And I wouldn't say that the light went off immediately. It took some time, but, you know, as we were, you know, deeply involved with Compass in the early days, it was, you'd start to look at activities like mortgage, and then you'd go down the mortgage rabbit hole. How is a mortgage manufactured? Holy cow. Are you kidding me? And the more you learned, you know, and it, again, it's like, it wasn't because like the people were inefficient or ineffective. It's just because that's what the industry was at the time. And great products hadn't been built to solve those inefficiencies. But as we started meeting with more and more founders, we would see everything from property management to, then we started looking at commercial and we're like, wait, how do you search for commercial? There's one site and that's what it is. It's just like, that's it. And of course that led to an investment in a company called Crexy. And so it was just this first principles mentality towards investing in differentiated, defensible companies that led us into real estate. And what we really started to appreciate was that you had to understand the sector. You had to understand the sector and the people, how things worked. And it was just hard to drop into and make good decisions on a regular basis. And frankly, we just loved it. I mean, we just were interested in it. And as a child, I actually, my parents, as their side hustle, bought and renovated residential real estate, income producing real estate. And I'd spend weekends, you know, raking leaves and painting fences and doing the move out inspection with my dad and like literally moving out stuff that was left behind. And so I saw early on what it meant to buy real estate, hold real estate, invest in real estate. And then it was really fun for me to start to marry that with kind of a more technical approach to investing in early stage companies in a sector that needed a lot of technical transformation. So that's kind of how we got there. But I'll pause there because I've been going for a while.
I think that's fascinating. I love that. I mean, you know, there's, of all the companies you could have picked, I mean, to happen to be friends with a co-founder and, you know, and be willing to back them, you know, Compass is a pretty extraordinary company to have. Like, that's your first foray into this industry. And you're right. Even when I got started in prop tech, I was still like trying to figure out, is it real estate tech? Is there a difference? There's all these different terms. Every once in a while, people ask me to like, what do you define as prop tech? And I kind of shoot back because at this point, if a business doesn't have any technology, I'm a little bit more confused as to how that's possible. So I'm like, I'm not sure what makes it special, but it's just the category. It's do you have defined lines for what you draw as like real estate tech or prop tech? And we'll even get into construction tech later on.
Sure. Yeah. And look, you're absolutely right. And I think it is definitionally broad, and really the narrowing is by fund and strategy. And for us, you know, we've narrowed it quite substantially, but it can include every category from residential to commercial to, in our case, construction, and increasingly towards climate adaptation. And those are really kind of, I'd say, the four subsegments that we would be focused on. As a practical matter, we tend to be more focused on the commercial sector, notwithstanding our investment in Compass and a handful of other companies, which, you know, the residential sector is massive. But there's just been, I think, in the case of the residential, the first wave of PropTech, really what we call kind of PropTech 1.0, was a lot of business model innovation that was capital intensive, whether it was lease arbitrage, whether it was obviously capital structure arbitrage, whether it was, you know, buying and selling, and thus requiring a heck of a lot of capital to achieve the iBuyer model. So those, and we didn't participate in any of those. not because, you know, we didn't respect the founders and what they hope to accomplish, because they certainly have lofty goals. It just, like, for us, the way that we've always defined, it's really not prop tech. It's just, how do we define technology? Is there has to be underlying technical capabilities that are differentiated and defensible. And that means generally backing more technical founders who are building software and capabilities plus something else. And that plus something else is really important. And we can go very deep into what that plus something else is, because that will add to how they maintain their differentiation, how they maintain their defensibility over time. For us, that's important, because here we are in this highly risky category of early stage venture investing. And we view our job as kind of multifold. There's the kind of wide-eyed, excited, optimistic, we want to build something that will be a category defining company that will grow and be quite successful and live well past its dependency on venture capital dollars, but will be a solid, stable public company on the one hand. On the other hand, we say, well, how do we de-risk, right? Because investing is about risk reward. And as much as venture capital has seemed like a purely technology based undertaking, we are investors first and foremost who are using other people's capital, and we need to return it in multiples of what they provided it to us. And so we have to think about risk mitigation. And the way that we de-risk is by just being as certain as we can be about the differentiated, defensible capabilities of our companies. And so that generally leads us to investing into just pure software companies. So we tend to not invest in hardware, anything with capital intensity, anything where you could identify business model innovation over actual technical innovation. And we generally prefer vertical SaaS that serves, you know, enterprise-based customers or you know, perhaps, you know, if it's in the case of like Crexie, and we go into Crexie, you know, more of a long tail of customer, but they have this unique high point of distribution from having one of the largest listing sites. So that's the software plus something else. And we actually jokingly call that our special SaaS. because it really takes, you know, a special company to not just be a good idea, but to be durable from just initial ideation, initial growth to ultimate independence from venture capital, meaning cash flow positive and a pathway towards going public and being category defining.
So much in there, a handful of things to, I mean, themes to extract. You talked about, you know, you really have to understand and like dig into the industry. And I've heard this repeated from founders time and time again. Because oftentimes I ask the question of how, you know, where did you get started on this idea? Right. And there's usually one founder at least who came from the real estate side. But invariably, this is one of the challenges is even to finding the talent, because you might have the founders have maybe both sides of the coin, tech and the real estate experience, but it's really difficult to find that in like putting people on the bus in the right seats to execute the vision, you know, if they're lacking that context or ability to pick up that context. I'm curious from your perspective, and maybe it's, you know, some things that you've heard from your portfolio companies. Do you think talent is recognizing the opportunity that is prop tech, and it's gotten mainstream enough to where, you know, we're only going to continue seeing an acceleration of innovation, or are we just still going to kind of suffer from getting second hands on talent to execute visions in prop tech?
No, talent's, I mean, look, I think the talent across the prop tech ecosystem is fantastic. I mean, there's some very talented people that either have or don't have conventional real estate experience. I think we have both setups and both can work. There are industries, I mean, we have a company called Salus, which is a vertical SaaS platform for managing safety on site at construction locations. This was just an acute pain point felt by the founder, Gabe Guetta, who came from the construction sector and who lived with the compliance, the requirements, the 2020 hindsight after an event occurs, what was done in the days and weeks leading up to that event. Can they piece together the historical narrative for insurance claims from pen and paper that's sitting in folders and boxes in the trailer? And it was really hard and really scary versus this automated on-demand platform that they can search and keep digital records with and provide transparency throughout the organization to the HR departments, to the legal departments, to the insurance departments in real time with full visibility. And so it took someone like Gabe to see that unique problem and to know how ubiquitous that was across, not just actually in their case, the construction sector, but the general manufacturing sector as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example where somebody lived the experience firsthand. We have another early stage company called Perpexo, and mm-hmm. the founders don't come from the real estate sector. In fact, they worked at HubSpot and were product managers at HubSpot. And they understood the benefit of open platforms. HubSpot is a great CRM, and they're notably a very active app store where you can plug in any best-in-class application to that core CRM product and enhance the capabilities for products or applications that HubSpot doesn't build themselves. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Perpexo team, they were actually trying to build a rent payment platform for accepting digital payments.
Yeah, I remember.
Couldn't get past the fact that you needed to integrate with every PMS, property management system, the RDs and RealPages and MRIs of the world. And so their first principles approach to solving this was, we just should build a unified API for instant integration with the PMSs and actually solve what is an actual pain point mm-hmm. for technology that in of itself is not differentiated. Like if you're celebrating that you've built an integration with Yardi, like that's not, that doesn't get you points in the venture capitalist checklist of technical innovation. It's important, but it's not differentiated. And so why commit venture capital dollars, engineering resources to building something that you could literally pay somebody else to automate and be online in days versus months? And so that's a good example of they had no experience, but they could take a fresh perspective and say, wait, the technology stack in other industry sectors makes more sense and doesn't exist here. There's no middleware layer in real estate, in commercial real estate. And so let's be that middle layer. And it's, we were very attracted to that because for years we'd been meeting with point application, point solutions for the commercial real estate sector that, it's like, well, yeah, we got, we had a really successful pilot with, you name it, X, Y, or Z. And we'll be rolling out nationwide over the next 2.5 years, but they've, they run 8 different PMSs from acquisitions over the years. And just takes a lot of capital and engineering resources to get up to speed. And we just kept hearing that over and over again. And so when we met the team from Perpexo, formerly known as Propify, I mistakenly call them Propify, it was an acute pain point that we knew was a problem, that they knew was a problem, and they came about it not as industry insiders.
That's good. I mean, sometimes the outside perspective certainly can help. I mean, you're not wrong though. I mean, from the inside, everyone has said the same thing, especially when it comes to commercial real estate and integrating with the legacy PMSs. Like that's the barrier to growth for every new tool. And you're either looked at as a competitor or you're looked at as a risk to those ecosystems. And so then it's really difficult to do those direct integrations, and you can set up, leave it on the customer side to do things like, Zapier webhooks, but then you're relying on the customer to be technically savvy to do those things. Whereas, this is a great example of like a plug and play model where you're really solving the pain points to get to the thing that someone wants. It sounds like, I haven't seen it, the product itself, but I've been seeing the name pop up more and more. So good on them.
Some of your guests have been customers. It's great for them, right? I mean, I view it as core infrastructure for the prop tech sector, similar to how, again, in the late 90s, every startup had to have their own enterprise servers, right? Mm-hmm. They had to host their own websites, right? Before you had cloud computing, right? That was just an added cost to being a startup. This is yet another solution that you can provision on a month-to-month basis at a fraction of the cost that helps you scale up and put your dollars towards more productive uses like your core product. So I think it's a huge net positive infrastructure component to the prop tech sector. I'm really, really grateful that it exists.
It's very cool. I want to shift a little bit and talk specifics on Fund 3. Break it down. Talk to me about what this fund is, what its focus is on. And I'm even curious if you can talk about the type of investors that are coming to you with this confidence and believe in this vision?
Sure. We're announcing Fund 3, which is, for us, it's actually our second institutional fund. Our first fund was all funded by a single family. So it's our second institutional fund. And really, we raised it pretty close on the back of our Fund 2, which was a $65 million fund with 10 companies. And then we just closed Fund 3, which is an $80 million fund. So we're happy to increase the fund size. And really, Fund 3 is a continuation of what we've been doing in all of our history of Prudence, which is finding early stage companies, really seed to Series B, though our sweet spot is, predominantly Series A. We do some seeds and then even fewer mm-hmm. Series Bs is how it generally breaks down. We lead investments or co-lead investments. We have always taken a more concentrated view. And by that, I mean, Fund 2 had 10 portfolio companies. Fund 3 will have 10 to 12 companies. So we raise what we need to execute our strategy, which mm-hmm. is to find the 2 to 4 best investable opportunities every year, and then really have the bandwidth to support our companies, both post-closing with their initial company build and go to market as they go from kind of generally seed stage to Series A stage, which is a heavy lift. If you've been through that, it's a very heavy lift to make that.
It sounds like you guys really are like concentrate. Like those investments they're bigger investments. Like you're not looking to spray and pray across a whole bunch of, earlier stage, which seems to be, over the years, that's become a little bit more of the popular strategy, right? Invest earlier stage, smaller check sizes, reduced risk, but obviously like upside down the line increases. But here it sounds like you're willing to pony up, but you're really only looking for what kind of fits in that buy box and is best of class.
I think, yes. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think it all depends on your view on how you de-risk. Our view on how you de-risk is that you invest in your highest conviction ideas that you can most properly vet for pain mm-hmm. points that are the most acute, for the solutions that are the most loved, right? So you end up with products that are built in the hands of customers. You can measure customer engagement and ultimately the criticality of the product to the end user, and thus their willingness to pay and to stay. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, you can start to build out the early stages of figuring out what that company's go-to-market looks like as they have more capital to invest in that, hopefully based on identifiable metrics that they've achieved from the minimal kind of seed and pre-seed dollars that they've raised, and thus have a early growth case such that the companies we invest in go through a nice period of hypergrowth after we invest, but are doing so with confidence that they've actually answered a lot of important questions. That is hard to find. That is really hard to find. And so you have to have that as your intentional goal and keep mm-hmm. the bar incredibly high to make those 2 to 4 investments per year. And so we de-risk by finding what is exactly the type of company, exactly the size of the opportunity, the mentality of the founder. If we can find all of that, then we want to actually own as much of that as we can and reserve capital to continue investing in that company. And what we found is that our founders really appreciate that approach. We have the time for them. We have the mental bandwidth to be that first call and to help them through tricky questions they're trying to answer. I think that has paid off. I mean, one of the things we're really proud of is the number of the founders that we've backed in the past that are actually investors in our fund now, which was the second part of your question, which is, who's in your fund? And I think this is really important to emphasize. The prop tech sector has evolved quite a bit over the last 8 years, from the days where it actually didn't have a name called prop tech. I think the early movers in the category, aggregated a lot of venture capital dollars and really had this view of kind of like corporate venture capital, where you're outsourced corporate venture capital arm, and we're going to aggregate as much capital from the industry. And, we're going to use that to help learn and to, test companies during our due diligence. And I think there's a lot of logic to that. And I think that mm-hmm. they're in a category, again, the largest global contributor to GDP, there's room for multiple different approaches. Ours is a bit different. I mean, we take a technical lens through this. And so our investor base is predominantly institutional investors that are solely returns seeking investors. They want us to invest in the highest and best potential returning opportunities with the most differentiated, defensible technology companies that we can find and underwrite. We do have a handful of strategic investors as well, and they're fantastic to work with. But what we want is the prudence. You know, if we do our job right here, we want when prudence invest for it to be a strong signal to generalist investors that this is a great technology company. And so we try to keep the bar as high as we can. And we are investing because we think this is a great company that will be appealing to a wide swath of investors. Because ultimately, for our sector to be successful, we have to be able to attract capital from other sectors. It can't just be prop tech only. Right. And that's important. I think it's great when prop tech investors invest early. I think it shows an innate understanding of the pain point and the efficacy of the solution. But for something to be venture scale and returns, there has to be a degree of a generalized, capital efficient, technology based solution for it to be really kind of industry transforming.
Do people still use the term crossing the chasm? Because that's what comes to mind here. It's like,
yeah, for sure.
we're going a little old school here, but I mean, honestly, it's an illustration I think about still quite a bit. I mean, you have your early adopters who love the novelty or the idea of something. And the more that business demonstrates signs of life, the more, especially if it's consumer facing and becomes more mainstream beyond just early adopters, but for people who now recognize a category. Like, I mean, there was no category for iBuyers. The only buyers that anyone interacted with that were similar to iBuyers prior to, you know, OfferPad and Open Door was the occasional realtor who said, I'll sell your home. And if not, I'll buy it in 120 days, which was, that used to be a pretty compelling offer, or wholesalers.
Oh, yeah. So,
right. Those are the only two people who said, well, buy your house as is, don't change a thing. Right. And now we have a whole category and it's like crossed so many chasms to where it's recognized to the general consumer and anyone can invest in it. You know, it's gone the full gamut. And of course it's a long and arduous path and some have taken easier routes, I think, than others. I don't think the iBuyer route is by any means an easy route of a business, but
buying's a tough business. There's no question about that. That's we spend a lot of time on it because as you can imagine, if you're in the sector, you know, everyone's saying like, well, what's your take and what's your angle and what's your participation going to be in the iBuyer sector? And respectively, it was just not for us, but for a variety of reasons, but it's like, I'm glad it exists. I think its innovation was hugely important. And I think there's a segment of the economy that the convenience and the speed and certainty is worth it, right? Now, for most people, it won't be unless you can show that you don't have to take a discount. For most people, and this is probably the problem, and again, we're not like experts on residential. We spend more of our time on more technical challenges across commercial and construction. But I will say this. I mean, I think that there, for most people, and this is probably the blind spot that the venture capital industry brings to the residential ecosystem. They kind of want to lambast realtors and say, you know, they don't do anything. I could do it myself. And you always kind of want to put your hand on both their shoulders and say, yes, but for most people, the value of their home is their most important asset. To you, it might be basis points, right, of your net worth. But sure. For them, it's like it could be 80 to 90% of their net worth and they don't want to screw it up and they don't do it a lot. You market a property matters, how you create that kind of competition. And quite frankly, buying the house that's right is important too, right? Because then you're taking on a massive amount of debt. You could probably quarrel with the amount that agents are paid. I mean, I don't think that that's sustainable. And I think market forces are starting to drive that down. Actually, when you really look at it, everyone says it's 6%. It's actually closer to 5. And the more valuable the home, the lesser, you know, the lower the fee is. So there's actually there's some market forces at play here, which probably don't get the airtime that they deserve. But
you know that's not how media works, right? Let's just be honest about that. Yeah. We're not here to tell the truth here, Gavin. It's just, you know, I got to run with the headline. I have two more questions I want to get to before we've got to move down to the bottom of the show. So with the new fund, you guys are putting a little bit of emphasis into, or at least looking to the AI and construction tech kind of combination. Can you talk a little bit about why that's catching your eye and what you see as the opportunity here?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been actually Compass like rolled out, and I'll just detour for a second. Compass rolled out its first AI product about 5 years ago. We were actually deeply involved with them in that because we were looking at a company that had a similar capability. We were kind of bringing them, we brought them in with the company's knowledge into the due diligence. And so the idea of taking these massive sets of what were previously unstructured data and trying to derive insights from them is something we've been working on for a long time. And we actually have a company in Europe called Casafari in our fund too that I'd love to talk about at some point. But specifically with construction, construction and AI we have found, at least in this one instance where we've made an investment recently, an incredible product market fit. And you know, I think in this era, people are thinking a lot about generative AI and what can it do the job of a human? But I think in real estate, particularly in construction, computer vision is the most obvious mm-hmm. application, which is, you know, what can be seen from the photos across the widest possible surface area that can give you instant real-time feedback that can inform decisions and provide information across a set of constituents in a construction project, which is a very complex ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And it gets more complex the larger the ecosystem. So we actually invested in a company. We led the Series A for AI Clearing. The company's headquartered in Austin, but all of its like technical capabilities and even the founders spend most of their time in Warsaw, Poland, which is interestingly like one of like the hotbeds of AI engineers coming out of the Warsaw Institute of Technology.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, Google has 3,000 engineers in Warsaw. We just actually were in Warsaw 3 weeks ago, and Google has 3,000 engineers there. I think OpenAI, like 40% of the original engineering team, but it was all out of Warsaw. It's really impressive. It's worth a visit. But what they were experiencing was the inability of drone data taken over large infrastructure construction sites to provide an accurate assessment of the quality of the work completed and to track the progress. And as you can imagine, with infrastructure, think roads, railways, bridges, utility scale solar, large LNG terminals, you're talking about a massive amount of surface area that is nearly impossible for an individual to walk, take pictures, and take note of, you know, is everything on time and has everything been built right? It's a great application for computer vision. And most of the large general contractors are flying drones, which the drones collect images. In this context, they're called cloud points. But how do you then connect the dots between what is being seen, what was supposed to be built, and has it been built accurately and on time? And that is a massive identification of imagery, as well as a reconciliation of original plans and timelines. And you know, that is something that a computer can do in near real time. But if you had to have a human being overlay some processing to that, would take weeks. So it's artificial intelligence because it's the work that a human theoretically might be able to do over a very long time, but you can have it at a fraction of the cost and in real time. And what's impressive about this company, AI Clearing, is that they've gotten adoption by four of the top 20 general contractors globally. And these are firms like Bechtel, Vinci, Larsen & Toubro, and PCL. The end markets that they're serving are quite diverse, but their largest end market is actually utility scale solar, which is going through, as I'm sure you're aware, some massive growth as companies are viewing it as an alternative to coal in most cases. I think the global installed base of utility scale solar exceeded coal last year. It's like 21% of global industry energy generation.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Very cool.
So, I think what was particularly interesting about this company though, is the customers loved the product, right? And so I think you'd come at this perhaps with a view, I don't know, general contractors, they're old school. Do they really want to adopt technology? They want to solve pain points. They care less that it's AI and more that it works and that it is a massive improvement from what they were doing before. If you were the head of quality on a utility scale solar project, you know, covering 5 square miles with 1 million different components getting installed that had to all be installed correctly, and somebody said, what's the status? And you said, I'll get back to you in 3 weeks. That's not a good place to be.
No.
Right. And so the fact that they can have a real time view into what's being built is quite impressive. And it speaks to why they've been adopted across so many kind of major projects across the world.
The tactical takeaway here for founders listening to this is make sure your marketers are copywriting towards the problem and not just focusing on the feature of the tech first. I think that sometimes we see that the challenge is to not just talk about what your technology is, unless that really is the attracting or driving force. But what I hear here is that they care about getting the job done, articulating the problem, and you know, highlighting the solution, which it sounds like they have really developed something really interesting and cutting edge. I've got one more question here for you directly to the fund for the founders that are listening. You know, some of them might be seed stage earlier than that. Maybe they're at A, which kind of still within that buy box you've identified. What do they need to do to get on your radar, to get a pitch in front of you, show you what they're working on, to try and get your attention, to take a look at their business for potential investment?
Yeah, just reach out. We have a vast ingestion engine. We are tracking over 300 companies for follow up at any point in time. I think our CRM has thousands of companies we've met with in the past. Send us your information. Really lay out, right, what is the pain point you are solving. To the point you just made, Nate, this is so important. We are always fixated on the acuteness of the pain point and the quality of the solution, right? Such that you have very, very happy customers, right? That's a great place to start. And we like to understand that. We like to understand technical differentiation. We understand the defensibility, traction, customer referenceability. So just lay it out, but email us. We review everything. We have twice weekly pipeline calls. We, you know, if a company is just a little bit too early, you know, we are known for giving very detailed feedback to why we are not a pass, but a wait, and what we're looking for. AI Clearing is a good example of a company we met during their seed round. In fact, actually, we should do a little bit of analysis, but so many of our companies we passed after initially meeting them, but stayed in touch with them and invested later. And by later, I mean, like, we passed on the seed, invested in the A, or passed on the A, invested in the B.
Very cool.
So, my email is gavin@prudence.vc. Don't be shy.
Of course, we'll be able to give that to people in the notes here. We're going to move down to the bottom of the show. Last four questions I like to call for the future. This is when I get to ask each guest who comes on the show to give their best predictions based on the following four questions. Gavin, are you ready to play?
Let's play.
All right, let's do it. Number one, what does Prudence look like 1 year from now?
I'm going to take a variation of the question and answer it this way. What does Prudence look like one fund from now? Because you know, we work in kind of fund increments. And so we are going to continue to invest in our people and our processes. We have our own developed tech stack. We think, you know, as investors in technology, we have to be high volume users of technology. So we'll continue to invest in our tech stack and our unique data capabilities. You know, for us, it's actually pretty simple. We're going to keep doing what we always do. We try to make one good investment at a time. We try to be very thoughtful with what we invest in, the kind of people we work with, the types of founders. We have a type of founder that we really like, you know, the true believers. And we're going to keep doing that and spending our time and energy working with our companies as much as we can. And we're going to be able to do that because we just try to be as focused as possible. And that means fewer investments, more concentrated ownership, more time with our companies. And I think if we just keep doing that year in, year out, we'll be in a good place.
Number two, will VC investment be up or down this year compared to last in reference to prop tech?
Up, no question. We're past the hard part. I mean, now that there's like a somewhat of a sigh of relief that the Fed is, you know, not only done raising rates, but they're going to start lowering them over the course of this year. Who knows when? Probably May. But you know, it's like if you've survived this hard part, you know, you've done well as a founder. I think the VCs that might have slowed down their pace of investing for fear of, you know, A, how would their existing companies perform, and B, they wanted to kind of put off having to go back to market to raise capital. I think they'll start to see that, you know, there's a little bit of a lightning. It doesn't mean we're out of the woods, so to speak, as a category. Like, I think we have to put up great returns or, you know, the sector shouldn't exist. But this year we'll see more activity. No question.
Number three here on For the Future. What's one industry trend you think will continue, but you wish would go away?
I think there's certain parts of prop tech that probably are overcapitalized. And look, I am a believer in climate-based technologies. I'm just not sure that all the capital that has been formed to invest is going to find enough investable opportunities. I hope I'm wrong, but that, I mean, like, I think when you look at like climate change, you think about energy transition is massive. These are actually industrial-based solutions. And so we'll be investing in technologies that solve for efficiencies that face the sector that like AI clearing's in. So massive amounts of infrastructure investment, but industrial scale infrastructure investment is probably not itself a category for lots of venture capital dollars. That's going to be lots of infrastructure fund dollars. And so, yeah, we're going to try to find those solutions, but I'm just not sure that it's enough of a category to support all the capital that's been formed for it.
And the last one here, what's one thing you believe will dramatically change or fade away in real estate as a result of tech advances?
So I think the complexity of getting a mortgage is going to be something that's really different. We have a company called Maxwell. If you've never checked them out, they're actually like one of like the biggest, best, quietest companies that are out there. Maxwell has taken the entire process of manufacturing a mortgage and digitized it from start to end. That's loan application, processing, underwriting, closing, and then secondary market syndication, which is where all conforming mortgages go. Because it was such a human capital intensive process, it was super expensive. The cost of manufacturing a mortgage before Maxwell is $16,000. It's more than a Toyota Corolla, right? To manufacture a mortgage.
That's more than any car anymore.
And so, you know, this is inherently though digital information flowing through processes that will probably be augmented by artificial intelligence with perhaps a human in the loop. But the cost of manufacturing a mortgage is going to drop like literally like tenfold. Like I think it should be like $1,500 to $2,000. And so I think within that comes out the timing, the uncertainty, the complexity. And that's something that I think absolutely will change and change for the better.
Very cool. Gavin, this was a lot of fun. I feel like we got to go a little bit deeper into some of the philosophy and thoughts behind VC funding into prop tech. Congrats on Fund 3. Before we close out, for those who want to get in touch with you or learn more about Prudence, where do they go and how do they do that?
Yeah, please reach out. I'm at gavin@prudence.vc.
Easy enough. Of course, we'll put links in the show notes. You can always find those at technest.io. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to see you around. Until then, we'll talk to you later.
Nate, it was great to see you. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to TechNest, the PropTech podcast. Find all the links and resources mentioned in this episode on technest.io.
You can get future episodes delivered to your ears directly by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all other major podcast apps.
Follow TechNest on social media to stay up to speed on new developments, resources, and announcements in PropTech.
Your support is greatly appreciated. There's two ways you can directly support this podcast. Share episodes you find interesting, and then leave a review of the show in the App Store.
From Nate and the TechNest team, thanks for listening.